For those of you who are familiar with history, know that Australia started off as a penal colony of the British Empire, and that Australia has always had a problem with authority. We don't like authority, we respond to it badly, and that was our beginning, and it hasn't really improved since then. And with an election coming up in the next few months, there'll be the usual focus on the usual issues and the ugliness of politics. And I'm sure most of us feel the weight of some of the ironies in politics and of those that rule over us. So, for example, it may soon be illegal to use corporal punishment to discipline children, as it already is in New Zealand, but it's perfectly legal to kill them before they're born. A few elections ago, I remember the government wanting people to brace themselves for a less optimistic future, which basically meant you're going to have to tighten your belt, while they were increasing their own salary packages extremely generously. A politician that served a couple of terms in government, pensions off on 200 Gs a year. So how should Christians respond to such government? Should we despise and mock them? Should we cheat on our tax in retaliation for their wastefulness? What about employers? Should we be slack and take heaps of sickies because they don't pay us enough? They treat us badly? How do we live when those in authority over us don't do it well? And this is especially important in Peter's context, where Christians were viewed with suspicion in terms of their beliefs creating social disorder. How do we live in this world as strangers and exiles who don't really belong? And the reason we're exiles and strangers is described in the previous verses, where our trust in Jesus as the ultimate expression of God himself and his rightful rule over us is the cause of our separation from this world. See, trust in Jesus separates us from the moral, spiritual confusion of our culture and the futile values we inherit from it. And if you look at verse 11, this is essentially the language that Peter uses of believers here. And the background to these words, exiles, strangers, sojourners, is the experience of Israel at different times throughout their history. Abraham was a sojourner in the Promised Land. He was a stranger in the land that his descendants would occupy by the grace of God. Another occasion where this idea is seen is in the exile to Babylon, where Israel were a small minority of foreigners in the dominant city of the world, which was pagan, which was ruled by a secular, idolatrous government. And this is why Daniel is such an important book, because it demonstrates how to live under such circumstances without compromising covenant faithfulness to God and trust in his sovereignty. And the first step in being able to do this effectively, still verse 11, is not indulging our desires in sinful ways. And this is quite clever of Peter and quite important, because at the heart of it, Christianity is firstly about inward transformation. We are to keep from expressing our desires in ways that are contrary to God's intentions for us. Because what ultimately sets us apart from unbelievers is our transformed hearts. Or as Peter has already expressed it, our souls are purified by obeying the truth. But keeping our sinfulness under control, keeping our desires directed in a way that God intends for us, is certainly not easy, is it? That's why I personally don't like the Christian life being described as a journey. It sounds a bit like we're on a picnic. It sounds, but Peter here describes our conflict with the forces of sin as a war. It's a full-scale war. It's an assault on our souls. It's an intense conflict that must be taken seriously because the stakes are so high. Sin destroys our humanness. It makes us hideous. It permeates our whole being. That's why in verse 12, our transformed hearts should manifest in honourable living, in day-to-day life. So people can see a true expression of the gospel and their transformation in the lives of believers as they do good works. See, at the time of Peter particularly, the gospel was new to people. It was misunderstood, misrepresented, and extremely dangerous in some people's minds. See, the reason it seemed dangerous is that it seemed to be advocating disloyalty to the emperor. It seemed to be upsetting trade and commerce with all this talk of slaves being free. What do you mean? They were accused of hating mankind because they didn't participate in the pagan festivals. And ironically, they were accused of atheism because they had no physical idols. But Peter's argument in verse 12 is that the gospel will by nature produce such transformation in people that the lives of Christians will ultimately silence such criticism and misunderstanding. Christians in every culture will be in many ways the best citizens, or so they should be. And the basic idea in verse 12 is that we live out this inward moral transformation. As we live that out, people will see that we live differently at a fundamental level. Basically, you can't argue with genuine moral transformation. In the early church, one of the arguments they could use to defend the gospel was the purity and godliness of the lives of Christians. There was no argument. Everyone could see it. It stood out in such an extraordinary way. Unfortunately, this can't be said in all segments of the church now. And that grieves us, doesn't it? It's dishonouring to the Lord Jesus Christ. But it can still be true in us personally. We still have the privilege of being examples of the mercy of God in taking people from darkness to light. And verses 13 to 17 describe what this should look like in terms of our relationship to the government. So look at verses 13 to 14. The basic idea is that God governs this world in such a way that human governments are put in place to maintain order, particularly by punishing wickedness and rewarding positive contributions to society. Obviously, because we live in a sinful world, governments don't always do this well. There will always be corruption, greed, arrogance, and injustice where there are people with power over other people. The Bible would be wrong about the human condition if this were not the case. So the question is, how do we as believers respond to such government in a way that honours Jesus? Well, simply, we obey them. As long as they do not force us to deny the lordship of Jesus, then we live under their authority, respectfully. We pay our taxes, even though they're not always used well. We be respectful of their position and not be belligerent and obnoxious people. Of course, we still should use our rights to bring change in a way that is appropriate in a democracy. Maybe we're too apathetic about using those rights. But we are not to be agents of disorder. And verses 15 to 16 expand on this. To understand these verses, we need to realise that our government is viewed quite differently than in the ancient world in some ways. The Roman emperor was considered to be a god and was worshipped along with the other Roman gods and goddesses. He was like a god king. I've not heard anyone yet attribute deity to Malcolm Turnbull or Julia Gillard. Yet in North Korea, even today, that is the case. The leader is considered a deity. But if you're going round in the ancient world saying Jesus is Lord and King, I'm sure you can see the problem. This would be quite concerning in a situation where the only king you were supposed to ultimately obey is Caesar. And this worried some people who thought that Christianity would lead to anarchy and rebellion against the government. Can there be two kings without violence? Jesus and Caesar. So Peter says believers are not to live in a way that despises the emperor or treats the government with contempt, but show that obeying Jesus makes you a model citizen. There is no threat to peaceful rule from Christians because they are to be the most loyal of subjects. So Peter says, this is how we silence those who foolishly misunderstand or misrepresent the gospel. Show that it is more effective at producing genuine benefit to society than any human political structure can ever be. And it is, isn't it? Take communism, for example, which we'll hear more about this afternoon. They tried to enforce communal generosity and created a nightmare. Look at the Christian community. One family over the 3 years we were in Ethiopia supported us to the tune of $50,000. The union movement, the feminist movement, the abolishment of slavery in its modern form all sprang from gospel people in terrible social conditions to change society for the better. This is what the rule of Jesus does. Be people who positively do good because that's the nature of the redeeming effects of the gospel. We don't need to retreat from society. We need to make a positive contribution which engage our society without compromising trust in Jesus. In fact, because we trust in Jesus, the possible alternative is described in verse 16. Christians could have used their newfound liberation from the ignorance of idolatry to do the opposite. They could have stirred up the Jews by harshly criticizing their continual slavery under the law. They could have mocked the government and said, "What kind of God do you think you are, Caesar?" Or they could have mocked others who still worshipped false gods and caused unnecessary trouble. So the issue is, don't under any circumstances deny Jesus, but don't cause trouble by the manner in which you do this. Peter reminds them that they have been freed from slavery to sin to the liberation of slavery to God. Like Israel rescued from Egypt, we've not been freed from a tyrant to be independent beings who live for ourselves. That's the very definition of sin. We've been freed from tyranny to be slaves to the rightful and good king. Martin Luther, the great reformer, said it this way: a Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none. A Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. Australians love to ridicule leaders. We're possibly the best in the world at it. But believers should be careful here, because they are God's instruments in maintaining order. God has set them in place over us. It's worth considering too when we vote. Do we vote in accordance with what is best for us personally, or whether we vote for what we consider to be the best for the spread of the glory of Jesus? So even if some of our laws are silly and unrealistic, obey them. This doesn't mean we ought not to seek change, to change things that need changing, but in the appropriate way. Peter's concern is that we don't malign the gospel by being difficult, disobedient, malcontent citizens of Australia. Pay our taxes even if the money is misused. Accept the umpire's decision without expressing concern about his ability. Drive at the speed limit. Get a plumber to put the roof on. Get a building permit when we're required to do so, for the sake of Jesus. And in verse 17, Peter sort of summarises things a bit by giving some priorities in how we love and obey others. We can see this in the nature of the words he uses to determine our behaviour towards the various people described here. Honour the emperor, but fear God. God alone is worthy of that level of respect. Honour all people, but be particularly concerned to love fellow believers. Of course, it needs to be said that where a government tells us to disobey God, then respectfully, we obey God. See, the concern here is not to be good citizens for the sake of it, but honouring Jesus in the way we live, because his honour is worth much, much more than our inconvenience and pride. The next issue, verses 18 to 25, relationship between slaves and masters. Now, the sort of slavery here is not the racist slavery we're familiar with, where people were forcibly removed and violently removed from their homeland and then sold into brutal and harsh submission. In the ancient world, most slavery was an economic necessity because there was no other welfare system. See, there was no Centrelink. So if you became bankrupt or without work, you sold yourself to another family until you could recover financially. For our purposes, it's more or less like the employee-employer relationship, without the option of quitting or the help of unions. So I'm not trying to diminish that slavery is not necessarily a good thing, but the slavery talked about here is not the slavery that we're familiar with. So in verses 18 to 20, we see how slaves are to respond to their masters. And the main idea here is that we should respect our employers regardless of how they treat us. See, our society thinks more like this. If someone does something for me, I'll do something in return, maybe. The gospel of Jesus says, do the right thing, whatever, because that is pleasing to God. So endure difficult bosses and injustice at work, because this is pleasing to God. And this gains the approval of God himself. And we will see the reason we can do this is because we know that God is extremely concerned about justice and all will be put right. And verses 21 to 25 show how Jesus is the ultimate example of doing this. Essentially, these verses are a series of quotes from Isaiah 53. And of course, most of you would be very familiar with that passage, because this passage is about how a suffering servant will bring about God's plans to save his people through a spectacular new exodus from slavery. The new exodus isn't just a rescue from slavery to a pagan country or a nutter king. This is rescue from humanity's greatest enemies, sin, death, and Satan. So while this is a great passage about the substitutional nature of Jesus' death, it also provides an example in that he selflessly did it for others. He did it to please God. Peter says, follow that example of accepting personal injustice at work, knowing that God's purposes to bring justice will ultimately triumph, and Jesus is proof of that. Specifically in verse 22, Jesus died in preference to sinning. This sort of approach to sin in the modern church would change this country. When he was mocked, he didn't mock or threaten in return, yet he had access to the power of God. He entrusted himself to God's justice. Jesus bore in his own body our sins and their penalty. He carried away our sin that we no longer live for sin. See, salvation isn't just some ticket to heaven, but deliverance from sin and death. That deliverance expresses itself now in how we live. Our sins have been taken away that we might live now for what is right. And it's worth commenting on the expression at the end of verse 24. By his wounds you have been healed. Healed in the Old Testament has a wider meaning than just healed of sickness. It has the wider sense of healing from all that afflicts us, including all the effects of sin in this world. So obviously this includes physical healing. Part of the salvation Jesus won for us, though, is ultimately the end of all the effects of sin, including sickness and disease. And in verse 25, we see that all this will happen because we have returned to the shepherd of our souls. In the Bible, the idea of shepherd isn't like Australia or New Zealand, where you treat sheep purely as a means of income and kick them and belt them if they don't do what you want. In the Middle East, sheep were known by name and shepherds would go to extraordinary lengths to save them from danger. They would risk their own lives to save them. The idea of God as shepherd is an image of great affection and care. And we've already seen in Peter, haven't we, that God will exercise his infinite power and great mercy to ensure all his sheep receive their eternal inheritance. So given that this is the God we serve, how do we follow the example of Christ in responding to those who are in authority over us at work? Well, he or she might be wrong. They might be full of themselves. They might not even be able to do their job well, but respectfully submit to them, because we ultimately serve someone who knows all about it. Jesus submitted according to the will of God to wicked people and their gross injustice against him. He knew that justice will be done. And who knows, in your respectfulness, the glory of Jesus may be seen by many others. I'm sure most of us, either as kids or as parents, have had experiences where our parents were proud of us or we were proud of our kids. Not so much for their achievements, but the way they went about something. I know as a parent, I'm much more proud of my kids, not for winning, but for persevering, for self-discipline, for overcoming obstacles. Winning is just a bonus. And Peter describes God here in some ways like a proud parent. Not in the negative sense of that idea, of course, but in the sense that God is pleased when his children behave like the ultimate son did. Nothing displays God's grace and glory as when his children act like him in the face of misrepresentation, ignorance, and hatred. But alternatively, there are not many greater tragedies in the world than when God's people act completely contrary to him. When sin is hidden behind religion. When our own personal reputation means more than the glory of Jesus. There is not much worse for the glory of God than arrogant Christians. Sexual abuse cover-ups in church. People who go through Sunday religious ritual with no real relationship to Christ. People who hatefully malign people with authority over them. And we need to take this seriously because it is a war for our souls, not just some ideological personal preference. How we respond to those with authority over us is a reflection of what we think of God himself. But as believers, we are no longer compelled by rules and fear, but by the grace of God and the glory of Jesus. As some of you may know, I follow the so-called New Atheism movement a bit, because it's good to hear what unbelievers say about the gospel. And one of the things that they claim, in an exaggerated way, of course, but they have a point, is that there is no visible evidence that Christianity brings any benefit to society. And they cite all the problems and cover-ups that are emerging in various church-related institutions. May God help us that this will not be true of us personally, and us as a local church.